Hey everybody, thanks for listening to this episode of My First Sketch at MyFirstSketch.com. I'm Josh Heilm. If you have any questions, thoughts, recommendations, feel free to email me at josh@myfirstsketch.com. I'll get back to you as soon as I can. You can like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/myfirstsketch. And since we're starting rolling, that will be more active than it has been. It'd be really cool if you rate it 5 stars and leave a review on whatever platform you get the podcast. I know Stitcher's gone, but, you know, whatever else. It's a new year and a new season of My First Sketch. I think the 2024 season of this podcast will last longer than last year's. There's already so much live sketch comedy planned for this year. I think we'll have plenty of people to talk to and things to talk about. A lot of stuff has happened since the last episode came out last spring. Long story short, Philly Sketchfest finally started producing shows on a regular basis, live and in person in front of real audiences. We started Cutthroat Sketch, a monthly sketch comedy competition show. Sketchball is where we're debuting new acts and teams that have never been to Philly. And Cavalcade is our characters monologue show that happens quarterly. Cutthroat Sketch takes place the first Thursday of the month at Sal Bonnet Creativity Project on Passyunk Avenue. The next one is this Thursday, February 1st at 7:30. It's entitled Heart. Two teams get randomly assigned together and then given a month to write a set. Then on the night of the show, I allow the teams to mess with each other with fun ways to sabotage them. All the information, including tickets, can be found at cutthroatsketch.com. Then, Sketchball returns on Wednesday, February 28th at 7:30 at Plays and Players Skinner Studio. We'll talk more about that in the coming weeks, but all the information and tickets can be found at sketchballphilly.com. Alright, let's talk about the big one. Philly Sketchfest is coming back in full, real, total glory. We did a mini festival in 2022, but this will be the first full festival in 5 years, which is bananas. We'll have shows and events from May 31st to June 8th. The film festival is back and live in a real theater, not just streaming on Facebook and YouTube. And the submissions for this year's festival will open Thursday, February 1st. Everything you need to know can be found at the newly redesigned and improved PhillySketchFest.com. This is the 200th episode of My First Sketch. I can't believe I've done 200 of these over the past 8 or so years. Whether you listen to one or all 200, thank you for being a part of this with me. For the 200th episode, I wanted to dig into a little history. So today's guest is one of the founders and current producers of Philly Sketchfest, Ben Marr. Ben is not a sketch comedy writer, so we don't have a sketch to read. But Ben has been behind the scenes and front of house at a number of the country's major stand-up comedy clubs, as well as working on Philly Sketchfest since its inception. So I thought it'd be a cool perspective. Here's my chat with Ben Marr.
My name is Samantha Russell. I'm a sketch comedian, and I have a prop and costume hoarding problem. So I figured the best way to get it under control is to start a podcast. On Should I Keep This? I chat with other comedians about their experiences in comedy and our insane prop and costume collections. And on each episode, we both bring a beloved item to discuss whether it's a treasure or just trash. Sometimes it turns out no matter how much money or time we spent on a prop, the only thing we should be holding on to are the memories we've made along the way. So check out Should I Keep This? We have new episodes every 2 weeks available anywhere you get your podcasts.
Hey, Ben.
Hello, Josh. How are you?
Good. This is a little weird since we're not starting with a sketch because you've been primarily behind the scenes for the last forever. What was like your earliest impression? What was your earliest memory of comedy?
It was probably all stems from stories that like my family likes to tell about how they knew I was going to do something in comedy for since, you know, I was little. I always liked it. The three things that they always bring up, and so I always like to bring up because they're actually kind of fun stories, are for my 10th birthday, my present was to see Weird Al and the Monkees on their the Monkees 25th anniversary tour or whatever, and it was it's still to this day like one of the best shows I've ever seen. The first thing they ever let me go to like by myself, was probably also when I was, 10, 12 years old or so. And Golden Gate Park, very close to my house, was San Francisco's Comedy Day in the Park. It's like a 4-hour marathon, free show, bunch of comics in the polo fields. Consistently draws about 8,000 to 10,000 people these days. Back then, it would get up to 30 or 50, depending on how, nice the weather was. It would get up to 30,000, 40,000 people over the course of the 4 hours. And my mom loves to tell a story about finding me once asleep in my closet, watching the like static of our local NBC station, because I had snuck the black and white TV up from our garage and would watch Carson and Letterman after I was sent to bed. I would sneak into my closet and watch the late night talk shows. And I'd fallen asleep on this chair that I had fashioned out of like a couple of boxes and stuff.
And that was a time where they were still going dark after a certain point. Like
I assume it was one of the things where, you know, the stereotypical show the flag and play the anthem and go, you know, I hate to say that because it makes me sound old, but yeah, I think that's what it was. I think there was still static. It might have been just infomercials, but who knows?
Like, I don't want you to feel old, because I definitely do remember like the quote unquote broadcast day starting with the flag. Like, that is a memory I do have of watching television as a kid.
It was like a kind of like a status thing that you were like, if you saw that when they went off the air, it was like, yeah, I stayed up all night, man.
Yeah. Yeah. I think for me, it was like my thing of like feeling adult was like getting past update on SNL. Like,
there you go. Yeah.
Like, which I was very hard to do when I first started watching SNL, but
yeah,
that was I taped the everything.
First,
so
that was one of the first things where it was like I was allowed to stay up later on the weekends. Was, can I stay up till that's over? You know, till Saturday Night Live's over. And you know, I probably, exactly like you just said, I probably just made it past update when I was first doing it, and then it would fall asleep.
Yeah, it was like getting to that musical guest and then update, and okay, I'm taping the rest of it, so it'll be fine. I'll watch it in the morning.
Yeah.
Or I'll watch it after church, actually.
I think at a certain point, maybe there were like, because it was another Lorne Michaels show, I think there might have been Kids in the Hall reruns on after it.
Oh, at a certain point, yeah, there was. I think so.
And so that was like, oh man, now I'm up all night.
So your biggest memory would be like, or at least your earliest memory was going to this Weird Al and Monkey show. Were you aware of Weird Al before going to the show,
yeah,
or were you going more for monkeys?
That's why we went, because it was like a twofer.
I think.
You know, it was like I had watched Monkey's reruns on Nickelodeon, but I loved Weird Al. I thought his parodies and originals were so funny. It was like some of the first stuff where I actually and I shouldn't say that in past tense, because he's still like my favorite everything. So happy when he won those Emmys a couple weeks ago. Yeah, it was a mix of watching the Monkees reruns on like Nickelodeon and thinking they were so funny, and then actually having his albums, you know, which when I was that young, I didn't really own too much stuff of my own. It was all like, you know, asking my parents if I could listen to their record or their CD or their tape.
So how did you find out about Weird Al? Because like, you know, those first 10 years of his career, like, did you have the Dr. Demento show?
Yes.
Like syndicated to you? Like,
it was on KFOG 104.5. And, okay. It was a Sunday night. It was on Sunday nights. And it was like what I would listen to right before I went to bed. Sunday nights.
So you theoretically were pretty close to the ground floor.
And I think, you know, I doubt he would ever hear this, and it pains me to give him any credit for anything ever, but my friend Mike Peterson introduced me to it.
To Dr. Domeno, the radio show.
This guy that I've known since like second grade, because his big sister was our babysitter, and he and I were the same age, so she would bring him along to play with me. And I'm just kidding around. He's a great guy, but I think he had made some joke or sang some song, and I was like, "What is that?" And he's like, "Oh, I heard it on Dr. Demento." And so told me when to listen, and the next thing you know, I'm obsessed with all these Weezy songs, and especially, you know, Weird Al, because they had that relationship since day one, where Demento was like his biggest fan, biggest supporter. Yeah.
So where do you get started with, like, so how does your comedy fandom evolve, like, into your teen years?
Well, I think it was a mix of just liking anything that was funny. From San Francisco originally, and so it's a tiny little town, and so my one set of grandparents, my dad's grandparents, were like literally 8 blocks away, and so I was over at their house all the time, and that grandfather was known, we called both my grandpas Papa, so they had to have further distinctions. So he was funny. So he was hilarious. And so whenever I was over there, we'd watch, you know, and it's kind of old school, but it was, you know, a grandpa, but we'd watch, like, you know, Three Stooges and Jack Benny. And I can remember watching, once again, betray the age, but I was a very tiny kid, but I do remember watching it, but like Lawrence Welk Show and the Mandrell Sisters and like all these variety shows on the weekends, yeah. Which oddly enough evolved into sleepovers on Fridays, and my grandma and I would watch our car shows with Dukes of Hazzard and like Knight Rider, which is hilarious because I didn't get my license till I was like 32 years old. So it was like it was definitely his side's influence. My mom's side is very funny, but we didn't know as many of them. It was just my grandpa and my uncles. Everybody else was in the Midwest. But my dad's side of the family is all smart asses and people who will give you a hard time, you know, from the second they see you till the second you leave, kind of thing. And so I think it was a mix of like familial stuff and then just always, you know, my parents liked stuff that was funny. So we were always like, if we watched TV, it was like, you know, sitcoms and funny movies and stuff like that. Just always been drawn to people who are funny and things that are funny.
We had talked about staying up for SNL, and I ask everybody this question, so I'll ask you too. Who would be your favorite SNL cast member of all time?
If you're going to just throw that at me, my first name that pops into my head is Dana Carvey.
Okay. San Francisco person.
Yeah. I think that probably endears him to me a little more. But beyond that, just like, I think it was on Never Not Funny the other day, one of my favorite podcasts, they were talking about enduring characters. And how he had more than probably anybody ever. If you had to just make a list, and they were like, you know, Will Ferrell is recognized as one of the greatest cast members there, but he didn't have nearly as many memorable characters as Dana, but he's had a much more memorable film career and stuff like that. But I think he just, and it goes back to discovering stuff. He was one of the first casts where like I could probably rattle off every name and I remember everything they did because it was when I was first really getting into it, and like, you know, going to school and quoting the sketches the next day, that kind of thing.
So yeah, I think I say it all the time where like, I think it was Jim Downey, like the, you know, that vaunted writer who had been around forever. he mentions that everyone thinks that the best seasons of SNL are the seasons that like you're in high school, like your sophomore, junior year of high school are the best of when SNL, no matter what. Yeah. And so I guess that totally makes sense. I mean, this is a weird question because you're probably still too young for it, though. But like, did you ever see Dana Carvey live before he went to the show? Since he was San Francisco based
still
for a while.
To this day, I haven't seen him because he, like back when he was on the show, and then when he had his film career and when he was doing movies, he split his time from what I remember. And so he never even really like popped in. He wasn't doing stand up, and he split his time between LA and the Bay Area. So I think when he was home, you know, he was hanging out with his family, and he never like popped into, when I ended up working at Cobbs, he didn't even like pop in to do like, you know, guest sets or anything.
Yeah. I feel like he was one of those guys that like almost realized that the corporate gig was way more like financially beneficial for him.
Yeah.
Cause I don't like ever really remember him being on tour or like I can't remember a time like in my adulthood or even like, in my teen, like Dana Carvey's coming to, you know, do a show anywhere in the Philadelphia area.
No.
Like doing stand up.
Not even like, you know, a casino or something where you might expect him.
Yeah. And then he says I was listening to the, you know, whatever that podcast that he does with David Spade about SNL, like, you know, he would talk about being on things and doing corporate stuff. I was like, oh, so that's where he's been for the last 15 years, basically.
And you're right. I don't remember seeing his name in, you know, in the past 20 years around here either, but I know he does stuff because I have a couple old buddies back in San Francisco that he brings with him to open.
So he must just be like
doing gigs, but they're probably like, I think you're right, they're probably private gigs and
80% private, or, you know, a few USOs every once in a while.
Yeah. Bigger stuff.
You had mentioned that I believe you said it was your mom that said that she knew that you would get into comedy somehow. What is your first step to getting into comedy somehow?
Well, it wasn't calculated as a way to get in, but it ended up being one, is just going to Cobb's Comedy Club out in San Francisco, pretty much almost every week for like 2 years straight, back when, as soon as I turned old enough, to go, because it was the way the California laws worked at that time, it was 18 and over, 16 or 17 you could go with a parent. So like popped in a couple times with my parents, but as soon as I was old enough to go by myself, I was there like all the time, because they had and it was weird because the way it worked, the punchline was 21 and over. We had two clubs when I first started going, Punchline and Cobbs. And there was like some weird law where like you had to serve a certain amount of your menu had to be food. And if it was, then you could be more lax on it could be 18 and over instead of 21 and over. And so the Punchline was 21 and over, 18 with a guardian or some weird thing like that. So I could go to Cobbs without anybody. I could go by myself. I could bring 20 people. I could do whatever. So I went there all the time. And like, when I say all the time, like my joke is always like what's 2 years, like 104 weeks. I was probably there like 80 weeks. Like I was there all the time. I'd like work my night job and go to the late show. Like I'd go on a Sunday if I had to work on the weekend, you know, I went like all the time and became like a regular. And like I said, it wasn't a calculated attempt to work my way in. It was just, I loved going to these shows and they were such good people, and it was a mix of locals and people brought in from out of town. And,
because I'm thinking, if you're going like 80 out of 100 weeks in a 2 year span, the you know, the jerk side of me is thinking, like, what weeks are you skipping? Who are you skipping and not seeing?
Well, like, that's the thing, is like, so the way that that club worked, it was like literally like two blocks off of Fisherman's Wharf. So the booker, eventually my boss and one of my mentors, guy whose name was Tom Sawyer, literally, and there's a great documentary about Cobbs having to move from the location that I worked at for most of the time I was there to a much larger venue called the Comedy Club. It's on like 2B and a couple other places now, I think. Free plug for them. But because such a large amount of its clientele was tourists, because it was so close to Fisherman's Wharf, they could repeat headliners. Something that like a Helium in Philly or a Punchline Philly or somewhere like that can't really do, just because of the way that it works. You want to draw in unique, you want to have a unique person all 52 weeks of the year, and you can't repeat. But those days, and because of the location, you could. So he would bring in his favorites two or three times a year.
Okay. Because so it wasn't like two weekends in a row. It was like that person would show back up 3 months later.
So it would be usually it would be his favorites slash his friends, so that he could hang out with buddies. But also, we were so spoiled, his buddies were some of the best comics you've ever seen in your life, or locals who wanted to come home and visit their families. So, you know, you'd have Greg Proops three times a year. You'd have Jake Johansson three times a year. You'd have Dana Gould three times a year. Or, you know, they do the Punchline, then they go to Cobbs, then they do the Cobbs twice and Punchline once or whatever. So, you know, sometimes I'd be like, I could take a week off. I just saw this guy in March and now he's back in August. And like, you know, it's some of my favorite people. Like, you know, if you get the chance to see Dana Gould twice in a year, you should take it. But at the same time,
you don't need the third time.
That's if I was skipping, that's probably why. And then every once in a while, there'd just be somebody that wasn't my cup of tea. But honestly, I can't even remember off the top of my head who that might have been.
So you become a pretty ardent like stand-up fan.
Yeah.
Like,
I mean, I you know, I love all the forms, but that was the most accessible.
Right. I mean, because I meant to ask, like, was there, like, I don't know why I'm going to say improv, because improv is just really starting to move roughly at that time. But was there like a live sketch comedy scene in San Francisco at that point?
At that time? No, not really. And if there was, I was ignorant of it.
Yeah.
But I think that was a time where it was kind of stagnant. And if there was, it was not a vibrant scene. It was maybe one or two groups, or it was people that were, you know, just throwing stuff together. And it was more like, at that point, one-man shows were starting to take off.
Yeah.
Especially there. Dana had a really great one that was super critically acclaimed, and a couple other people wrote one. I think that was about the time that Defending the Caveman was becoming a big thing, and that was Rob Becker, and he was from San Francisco. So like the comedic one-man show was becoming a thing back then, but I don't think there was that much sketch, at least in the early to mid-90s.
And like, I don't,
hears this and can correct me, that's awesome. But
so you start working at Cobbs then, right?
Yeah. So I went for like 2 years, for my 20th birthday party. My boss, Tom, would go nuts for New Year's week. Right. So he would book a feature to host, a headliner to feature, and a headliner. And then on New Year's Eve itself, bring in a third headliner to be like a guest set. So the shows from the 26th through the 31st were always ridiculous. So my birthday's right before Christmas. So I had a birthday party when everybody was home from their from college. So I brought 65 people down to a Wednesday show to see Greg Barrett host, Janine Garofalo feature, and Dana Gould headline. And it was a Wednesday, so it was $10 to see that show. So I brought 65 people down. He didn't believe me that they were all going to show. They all showed. And the woman that worked the front desk, Stacy, who I had become good friends with from being a regular customer for so long, was like, "Hey, I just gave my 2 weeks. Do you want to apply for my job?" And I was like, "There's nothing more I'd like to do than apply for that job." So I filled out an application. Part of the job included writing the press release every week.
Okay.
So I wrote a sample press release for three of my favorite comics. I'm pretty sure it was Proops, Clinton Jackson, and probably Dana or Tom Rhodes at that point. And I got hired right after the new year. And so I started right when I turned 20, and I worked there for a decade till I moved to Philly.
So 10 years behind the scenes in, you know, working with publicity, and I'm assuming some kind of customer relation at some point.
Oh yeah.
At a comedy club.
Front of house where for most of that.
It's an interesting perspective to see how comedy would change in a decade's time.
Yeah. It was an interesting decade too, because it was 95 to 05. So it was like you said, when I was a customer, it was the boom was kind of waning, and then it did come back. I feel like it came back twice while I was there in different strengths.
Okay.
You know,
that's possible.
There was never another boom to the extent of the early 90s where there was like over, I feel like I read somewhere or heard something that there was over like 400 clubs at some point in the early 90s in the country.
Wow. That's a lot.
I don't think it ever got back to those huge numbers, but yeah, it definitely had another peak or two while I was there, I think, with, you know, just popularity and interest. But it was fun, exciting times.
All right. So what prompts the move to Philly?
Helium. So like I was saying, that documentary that they did on about Helium, the main impetus of it is, I can't remember. I think the director, this guy, David Shandell, I think he kind of got our bad luck was his good luck, because it made the documentary much more interesting that there was a fire in the building across from us where we were in the cannery down by Fisherman's Wharf. It was the first 5-alarm fire in San Francisco in like 25 years or something. It was insane. And they were refurbishing this old bottling factory into a 5-star hotel, and some welder left his torch on overnight. And as Greg Fitzsimmons was finishing his late show on a Saturday night, I think it was March 16th, it was like the night before St. Patty's, so it was a rowdy night. People were like, "Do you smell smoke? I think we smell smoke." And so as our audience was leaving the club, the building right across the courtyard is literally on fire. And so we're like, "Everybody get out, everybody get out." And then the firemen start showing up, and they're telling us to leave, and we couldn't, you know, close out the night. And Tom and I are the last ones out, and we're literally holding our jackets over our heads because there's like ash raining down. And it was insanity. And they had to pump all this water from the bay which is like, you know, a block away, to put it out, and it flooded. We were below street level, so it flooded the club like 2 feet worth of water, and so it's fried all our electric and it fried everything, and we were closed for 2 weeks to fix all the walls and rewire the whole club and paint everything, and it was just insanity. And so that started a whole crazy thing where we ended up not renewing our lease after 20 years in that spot. And so we're closed for like 7 months, 8 months till we found a new spot, and it changed the whole dynamic of the club. We went from 188 seats to 420 seats.
So that's changed, a big jump.
It and 420 seats, including a 100-seat balcony. So it was like the whole, it was insane. It was a whole different club in every single way. But while we were closed, Mark Grossman, the gentleman who owns Helium, was talking to the Sklar brothers, because he knows them, and he was like, hey, I'm looking to open a club in Philly. Who should I talk to? And they gave him the name of a bunch of owners slash managers of clubs to talk to on that side of it. And then they said, you know who you might want to talk to run it? We know this guy, Ben. He's the like floor manager of Healing of Cobbs, and they're closed right now. We don't know what he's doing. We don't know if it's going to reopen or not. You might want to give him a call. So he called me. We chatted for over a year on and off. And I was his number one hire. I was the first person he hired, and I moved out in January of 2005.
So we have the Sklar brothers to blame.
Yeah. Thank is the word you're looking for. That's easy. It's nice because you can spread out the blame over the two of them. So it's like,
We know it all of Randy's fault more than Jason's.
Yeah, it's all Randy.
All right. So you moved to Philly to help start a new comedy club here in the city, which kind of like matches up with me, because like I leave college in 06, and like I knew that there was a little bit of comedy in Philadelphia. Like one of my friends in high school had gone to see Comedy Sports. And he wrote a thing for our newspaper about it, because like Whose Line Is It Anyway became a huge thing on TV roughly in my high school years.
Right.
So Comedy Sports would have been right up that alley. And I think I knew the Laugh House, but I didn't know what the Laugh House was.
Okay.
In terms of, you know, where it's standing in the stand-up world would have been. So, you know, coming home being like 19, 20 and finding out that there is a new stand-up club in Center City was kind of a revelation.
Right. That's got to be cool if you're like coming home and looking for stuff to do. And
so what was it like to open a new club in a new city for you?
It was pretty wild, especially because like you just said, it was a new city. So like, you know, I'd been a regular club customer at both of the clubs in San Francisco. So even before I started working there, I knew who the comics were, and, you know, I would talk to some of them after the showcases, and I had become friendly with some of them. They recognized me and stuff. But yeah, I didn't know literally a soul. I knew people who were from here, but I, you know, I had one friend who lived here. So that was, you know, that was it on the terms of like a personal relationship. But professionally, I didn't know anybody that was here, that was still here. You know, I had met Todd Glass over the years. And, you know, I probably Ralph Harris, you know, I'd met Philly comics, but nobody that still lived here. So that was interesting, because I got here in January, but we didn't open till June. So I was doing all sorts of prep stuff for the club. And one of the main things I was doing was trying to go to local shows, just so I would have a pulse of like who people were, what the level of talent was, et cetera. Because part of my job was going to be to book the support acts. Lewis Lee, who owns and books Acme Comedy Company in Minneapolis, and Rich Miller, who owned Cap City, they were going to handle booking the headliners, but I was going to be booking the local support. So I had to go out and see who that was going to be. Yeah. And it was funny because I would go to shows and, you know, I'd see a lot of the same people because the scene was decent at that point, but it wasn't huge. So I'd often see the same people on shows. And I try to take, you know, try to take notes, remember who was who and who was good and who was bad and who had potential, et cetera. And then a couple comics, Pat House and maybe somebody else, told me later on, once we became friendly and were friends with each other, knew each other, that I distinctly remember Pat saying he thought I was a new comic who was stealing jokes at one point because he saw me writing stuff down during shows more than once. And he was like, I got to keep an eye on that guy. I think he might be, if he tries to go up on stage, I'm going to listen to his act because I think he's trying to write down people's jokes. And I was like, no, I was just writing down whether or not you sucked.
And guess what? You didn't.
Yeah, no, you passed. You're okay. 3 albums later, opening for Sebastian Maniscalco at the Wells Fargo. You're okay. But yeah, so I had to get a gauge of the local scene.
Yeah, like, and so you said it was a decent sized scene. Like,
well,
because I don't think I started going to shows until like maybe like 08, 09. Like, I didn't turn 21 until 07.
Okay.
So I wasn't very, you know, adventurous. Like, I was very perfectly happy just staying in my suburbs and drinking with my friends instead of going to shows for a while. So how was the scene?
So
especially compared to what you knew in San Francisco.
Oh, it was quite different because San Francisco scene was a lot, at least what I got exposed to. And then when I was working at the club, I was working at the club five nights a week at a couple points during that decade, 6-7 nights a week, you know, just because of circumstances or whatever. But it was very different just in the sense that there were a lot of comics, like a lot is a relative term, but like a good amount of comics hustling and putting on shows in Philly, but they were bar shows. Like, yeah, there weren't. So like you said, until you were 21, you wouldn't have seen them. You wouldn't have had a chance to see them anyway. You know, these days there's more, the shows are more like spread out, you know. I mean, there's still bars, there's still wineries, but there's also, like, you know, little theaters where people put on shows, or, you know, coffee shops, every, you name it. But back then it was like a lot of bar shows, and Laugh House was the only legit club in town, and it tended to skew urban no matter what. So like on the weekends it was definitely true, but like I would go to their open mic sometimes on Wednesdays, and WID hosted it, and anybody could get up, and it would go. I think they didn't stop the list. It was just everybody that signed up. So like it would go till like 1:30 sometimes. I remember more than once going to their open mic on 2nd and South and then grabbing a cheesesteak at a Jim's and eating it while I walked home to 20th and Walnut at like 2 a.m. It was not a good recipe for anything. But
I mean, at least you're working off the carb, like,
yeah,
the,
right?
The calories.
That was,
as
that
you
was
go.
My excuse. It wasn't because I was, you know, too cheap to get a cab. But yeah, so like there was a lot of people hustling to put together shows, but you know, there was only one club option. And you know, they weren't doing like the sort of things like these days. There's matinee shows, there's super late shows, there's a little bit of everything. People put together a festival, you know, left and right for So it was different. It was very different back then. But like I said, you see some of the same people because it still rang true. Like there's always like people that rise to the top and everybody wants them to be on their show, kind of
Yeah.
thingy.
You move here in 2005, and according to the Philly Sketch Fest website, the first festival is 2008. So, how aware are you of the sketch comedy scene in Philadelphia in, those 2 years before the festival starts?
So, it was kind of a peripheral thing. I hoped there was one. I looked for one, but I didn't. What I found was was sparse, but good. Does that make sense? Like, so what I found at that point was, and it still exists, and it will exist long past all of us because it's like technically the oldest sketch comedy troupe in America. But the Mask and Wig Club up at Penn, but that's its own little thing, and they've been on Sketch Fest a couple times, and they're always welcome to come back. But they've just got their own theater, and they've got their own thing going on up there. But that was a thing that I found when I was, kind of like would do an internet search or something. And I believe that was that around like the origins of Secret Pants. So I know I saw their names a
Yeah,
few
roughly.
times, but I think all the there were groups, but there weren't that many of them, and they were all doing there it was the same thing, kind of like it was an indie thing. It wasn't There wasn't anywhere that was doing exclusively sketch or
Right.
exclusively.
So tell us about the creation. How do you get together with Dave Taruso and Matt Lally and Philly Sketchfest is born?
Okay, so as we've established, or I hope we have, I love sketch, and so in a nice bit of happenstance, Dave and Matt's group, Animosity Pierre shows up one Tuesday night at Helium at the open mic and says, "Hey, we'd like to sign up, but we're a sketch group. Will you let us sign up? Can we do a sketch?" And I was like, "Oh, this is great. Sure. Of course. Yeah. I'll give you 5 minutes. Do you have any 5 minute sketches?" And they're like, "Yeah, we can fit something in there, no problem." And it was one of those things where I was like, this is so cool. I didn't have to like seek out a sketch group. I always was open to that. When I was running the showcase in San Francisco, we didn't have an open mic. We had a showcase. It was very similar to an open mic in the sense that it was 15 comics every Wednesday, but they had to call in. And we kind of like knew who they were. It was a little
Yeah.
more
It
exclusive.
wasn't
And
just sign up
so,
and come in.
yeah, exactly. But I know you know this. This is more it's rhetorical. But Jesse from Maximum Fun
Yeah.
and Jordan Morris. Yeah, so they had a sketch group called Prank the Dean. And
Okay.
they did the showcase a couple times, and I told them whenever they wanted to, they could come by and do it. But they went to school in Santa Cruz, which was an hour and a half away, so they didn't come very often. Animosity Pierre was the opposite of that. It went well. They all went to LaSalle. It went well, and they started coming by. And I was like, it was so much fun to have a sketch group to kind of just, especially if you have a open mic. Our open mic was like 20, 25 comics. So to break up the monotony of the same, guys going up for 3 to 5 minutes and all talking about the same subject or whatever, it was so much fun to put up a sketch group and just have it be something unique. And the comics even liked it. They thought it was fun and interesting. And then, 1 week they'd come in and they'd be like, "Hey, all four of us want to do 3 minute stand-up sets instead," and do stuff like that and mix it up. And then slowly but surely, over I guess that was probably around 06. It was fairly early on in the open mic process. And then slowly but surely, the four members of Animosity Pierre became the two members of Animosity Pierre. People moved.
Oh, away. I didn't even know that there were four.
Yeah, there were four when they first came in. Yeah.
Okay.
And then I guess Graham moved away, and it just they slowly but surely just got down to Matt and Dave just being a duo. I told them one time, kind of jokingly, that besides trying to do what I could for the Philly stand-up scene, when I moved here, my two goals were to start a sketch festival and open a bowling alley. My two of my favorite things, comedy and bowling, which I don't do. I would do one of them. I'm involved with one of them 7 days a week, and the other one I haven't done in years. But and they both kind of, especially Dave, kind of latched onto it, and they were like, "Oh, that'd be so cool!" You know, we're just starting to see more groups perform, and we've got a solid amount of them now. And I think it was right after they had just done a show with a couple other groups, or I think they had done Chip's show, or maybe even Don Montre's show, Die After Die, and he was always, you know, real open to sketch. And I think we kind of glossed over this, but the people who started the San Francisco Sketch Fest in college were three of my real good friends. I'm still friends with all three of them, especially Cole. But I had been a house manager for a couple years for them for some of their shows, and just loved it, the atmosphere and the idea of it and everything. And so I thought it would be really cool that if there was enough groups out here to do the same kind of thing, because Philly has a very, in my mind, Philly has a very similar aesthetic. You know, it's a couple hours away from New York.
Yeah.
So you could pull some good, talented people. And, you know, it's a thriving art city, especially now. And just, I thought that would be a really cool idea. For Philly, we actually had 8 strong groups. And we just did them all over the course of one weekend.
Yeah.
So I have the, I've shown it on a Sketchy Bader, which I assume people who listen to this know what that is. But I think I've shown it to you on Sketchy Bader, but I got one big tiny little crate that has like all the historic stuff I could find. I just all put it in one box once from Sketchfest. So I have a program in front of me so I can rattle off the names if that's cool.
Yeah, I mean, I have it on the website because we just redid the Philly Sketchfest website.
Oh, yeah. So go check Animosity that out,
Pierre.
Folks. Yeah. So Pierre is Dave and Matt, the other founders.
Boy Meets Tractor from Swarthmore.
Yeah, they actually won a contest that we did at Helium for an extra spot. We did a college contest.
Oh, interesting.
We got, I think it was four, five, six groups from local colleges.
Hmm.
And we did a show at Helium to hype the Sketchfest. And I think it was a mix of judges and audience vote, and they won. So they got a shot. They got a spot on the show with all groups.
You also have Rones and Hastings, Gentlemen's Rotary Auxiliary, the Wait Staff, Bad Hair, Matt, Megan, Rob, Secret Pants, and the Sixth Borough.
Yeah, it's pretty badass if we ever tried to get these groups back together for like a 20th anniversary or something.
Which was that in 5 years?
But I mean, four think years? About it. I mean, I don't know how many of those groups you got to see yourself, but any of these shows, that's a ridiculous. These are ridiculous shows, if I do say so myself, even all these years later.
I think with some of them, I've never seen them as the full group. I've only seen members doing other things. Like, I don't think I've ever seen like the Sixth Borough as the Sixth Borough.
Right. But you know,
but I've seen members of Sixth Borough doing other things. And Meg Favreau left Philadelphia just as I was getting in doing stuff. So I never saw Meg and Rob together. I've only seen their videos. I talked to one of the members of the wait staff. Do they still do things? I don't think they still do things.
No, they're still around, but I don't think they've done anything together for a while. I think the closest to being together still is Secret Pants.
Yeah.
And they're technically, you know, not, technically they're, not.
They're, but, so I yeah, mean, this first year.
Time ago, that's 2008.
So how does the, like, the planning for that first year happen? Like, how, why did you pick the Painted Bride Art Center? Like,
so
did you just pick the teams that you wanted to do it? Like, there was no, like, submission process necessarily?
Yeah, that year was pretty much, like, I guess, for lack of a better phrase, invite only.
Yeah.
And it was just, that year specifically was just celebrating Philly comedy more than anything else. There, we didn't even open it up to anything else. And, you know, we got our favorite, we got Chip Chantry hosted all three shows. And we got our favorite stand up and we only had three shows. So it wasn't like we could spread the wealth like we have in subsequent years for stand ups hosting and stuff. You know, I think these days, if we do have stand ups hosts, it's a different one every show. Painted Bride was interesting because we went to that theater. We fell in love with that theater. We paid a lot of money for that theater and never used it again, even though it was amazing. It was gorgeous. It had 250 seats. It had a screen that took up like the whole back wall. It had this beautiful large stage and it just was, I think it was one of the things that you have kind of like wide eyes when you're trying to throw your first festival and make it as good as possible. And we probably should have built up to that being the venue because yeah.
You just saying 250 seats, I'm already like.
Yeah, no, it was way too many seats. And like, you know, we had decent crowds, but we also, and this is a perpetual thing. I think it's just, Philly is such an active city and there's so many people, but there's also so much stuff to do that, like, you know, and this is just brutal honesty. We've had the festival in almost every season of the year, except winter. We've had it in fall. We've had it in summer. We've had it in spring. And it's just tough to find a time when there's not other stuff going on. And so it was our unfortunate luck to schedule it the same weekend as the first Roots picnic. And I don't know if those two demos necessarily overlapped a ton, but like I think it probably affected us a little bit because we were looking for the same people that are going to those shows, you know, young, hip, cool people who wanna be part of a community event. So but you know, so we had 250 seats. We did not fill 250 seats. It was just probably a first year. I don't know if misstep's the right word, but like I think we might have like had, like I said, bigger eyes than we needed to.
Yeah.
In terms of, we probably should have found a smaller, easier venue. But I mean, it's super accessible. It's gorgeous. If I could go back there and have bigger shows, I would love to have bigger shows there. But you know, it's a lesson you learn. But that was the only misstep because the shows themselves were ridiculously good. I mean, if you look at that lineup, like you said, you only know people from other stuff they've done. But if you think about how funny they've been in that other stuff, you know, imagine how good they all were together.
What kind of lesson, like, and you mentioned, you know, your eyes being too big for your stomach, or what kind of lessons you learn as, you know, the next one happens? Like, was there any trepidation to do a second one the next year, or like
there was
cut back size of the venue
and trepidation, but it was all, the trepidation was all just making sure that we kind of all helped each other to rein that kind of stuff in. In the terms of like, okay, I think by the second one we had already pivoted to trying the fall because we were like, what are we thinking? Summertime in Philly, people that don't go to the shore are staying in town because they have plans. So we need to be one of the plans that keeps them in town, kind of thing, was one of the mindsets. And then I think the other was, you know, that theater was gorgeous, but it was too expensive. So let's find a smaller venue. Let's diversify the programming, you know, let's open it up. And I think that would, you know, that was the year that we started bringing in groups from out of town.
All right. So you've been basically the only person that's been involved with every iteration of Philly Sketch Fest. What have you learned? Like, is there something that, like, a piece of knowledge from being a part of the production team of a festival that you would pass on to sketch teams themselves? Not necessarily to someone wanting to write a festival, but like someone who's actively trying to.
Oh, so like
do this
for the people that are submitting or people.
Yeah. What's a bit of advice that you would give to a team that wants to submit and come to a festival?
You know, obviously don't just submit one sketch. I think you have to look at what the guidelines are and stick to them, because I can only speak from experience, but that's what you want. Those aren't thrown out there lightly.
No.
If somebody or some team takes the time to write up, you know, anywhere from 2 to 6 rules or whatever it is about, like, this is what we want for our submissions, they did that for a reason. And so if you adhere to that, it, at the very least, it increases your chances of making sure that you're going to get your whole submission considered properly, and that you can have a proper chance to get into the festival itself. You know, like, if we say your performance is going to be 15 to 25 minutes and we'd like to see, you know, an 8 to 10 minute thing, and please send us something that's representative of you, you know, send your greatest hit. Don't send some schlock. Don't send something that's dark and has bad sound. Don't send, you know, and a bunch of that is changed over the years too, because it's like technology has improved. You can fix stuff. You can film stuff on your iPhone that looks great these days.
And yeah,
like, you could tell
all of the shows that we've been doing in the last, you know, year between the Cavalcade, the Sketchball, and Cutthroat, and everything have just been filmed on my iPhone. Like, and it looks pretty solid.
Well, and in the years, during the pandemic, when we just went to videos only, all that stuff looked amazing.
Yeah.
And so, like, you know, it's out there, and, you know, some of it we could tell people spent real money on it, but you don't have to. And, you know, keep in mind, I feel like if you're submitting, it's always good advice to keep the judges in mind. And I don't mean like specifically, like, you have to like reach out and find out who they are and like, oh, it's
because
we won't tell you, first of all, but like, you know, don't keep them in mind in the sense that like, sending a like Philadelphia based sketch necessarily, like, that's not what I mean. But I mean, like, keep in mind that these people are probably going to be watching a large variety of sketch. And so send your greatest hit that's going to stand out, that fits the guidelines. If I can boil it down to one sentence, you know what I mean? If they say they want 8 to 10 minutes of video, and you have 2 4-minute sketches that are amazing, send those. You know, we don't necessarily want a 9.5-minute sketch. That's not what we're saying.
I know. I personally do not want a nine-minute sketch. I could say
definitely you do not, and I do not, and we have discussed that specifically in detail.
Yeah, so, okay. Are there any memories of, you know, the past 15 years of Philly Sketch Fest that like really stick out to you? Like, were there any like specific shows or people or sketches that loom large in your memory?
Yeah, I like that question because there's a couple things that stick out. That so we did, I think we only did this 1 year, but it might have been two, but it was ambitious, but I thought it was awesome, and I really wanted it to continue, but it just couldn't, it couldn't cohesively come together. But 1 year we did a thing called Philadelphia Comedy Month. And it was in November, so that we would take the week of Thanksgiving off, which led to what I always thought was a hilarious tagline, advertising line. So we call it Philadelphia Comedy Month, the three funniest weeks of the year. But so we partnered with the Matt Nelson and the Philadelphia Improv Festival. Most, if not all, the shows that year were at the Asian Arts Initiative. And that's what makes me think we did it twice, because some of the shows were at the Philadelphia Shakespeare Theater. But so the first week of November was the Improv Festival. The second week was Philly Sketch Fest. Third week was Thanksgiving, took it off. And then the last week was a spotlight on local shows, because that was a year or a couple years where there was a real prolific scene of indie shows. So like Doogie Horner's Ministry of Secret Jokes. I think maybe Chip's one man show was special guests, and other stuff. We either spotlighted them or we produced them for that month ourselves at the Shakespeare.
Okay.
And that was great. I really wish we could have found some way to keep a version of Philly Comedy Month going, because over the years, I hoped that the city would kind of get behind it and like the idea of highlighting our comedy scene. And I think that was the best way to try and get it done, is to like have it be an extended thing where they kind of couldn't ignore it.
Right.
You know, if it's just a weekend or just a week, even, I think they can kind of just be like, oh, it's just a thing they're doing. But if you had a whole month of shows, they'd kind of have to, pay attention. Another thing that's a good memory for me is the people that have come through the doors over the years. There was a group from Boston called Friends of Gertrude, and some of their members I'm still friends with. And they've been doing some great stuff. Sam Ike is doing stand-up up and down the East Coast, and he's hilarious. Dennis Hurley, one of their members, was in a Justin Timberlake video for that the song from the Trolls movie. The Inside Joke Films had to cancel on us the first year because one of them got sick, and then they came back for a second year and were great. And that was Jonathan Blaylock from
Shine Me Club.
Yeah. And Kimmy Schmidt and Rami Youssef from Rami, was an Emmy Award winner, Golden Globe Award winner. We can say we had him. and then you mentioned them earlier, Chris and Paul show. Some of our great friends, and they're on NBC's Bring the Funny a couple years ago. And I can't remember if they won, but they definitely were hilarious on there, and got to see some of their super imaginative sketches with a big budget. So that was awesome, because it was stuff that we had seen them do at like Plays and Players and the Shakespeare on these little tiny black box stages. And suddenly they were doing them in front of Jeff Foxworthy and Kenan Thompson on network television. And since then, Chris also he took over for Josh Gad on Broadway. In Book of Mormon, he was in a touring company. He's and just so guys like that have come through And, just the people that we're still friends with to this day, because that's kind of stuff means more to me than anything else. Just the people that we're still close with that we know through the festival. And, just stuff like Kurt coming on as a producer after being a performer and discovering High Drama and making friends with all of them and all that stuff.
Was there ever like a desire for you to actually perform or write or, you know, be on stage as a stand-up or sketch comedian?
Not really. I've always thought that like I like to try it a little bit more since like Twitter and Facebook and like online platforms like that have come around. I've been more willing to try to like write a joke, but I've never been great at like sitting down and writing a joke necessarily. I like to think that I can be funny, but usually it's like just in like spontaneously, like just sitting down and chatting with my friends and saying something in the moment versus actually sitting down and writing something. I will admit it to you, just to you, nobody else, that I've been trying to write a sketch for Sketchy Bader for a while now, and I just haven't gotten it done.
Well,
but I feel like it's a safe space that I can bring it up with you guys on a Friday night at midnight, and nobody will give me a hard time if it's not great.
Yeah, I'll just mute you if there's too many puns or anything. Like,
wouldn't be the first, wouldn't be the last. And I'm perfectly fine with going up for 30 seconds at a time and introducing a group.
Yeah, that can be fun too. I did a lot of that last year at the 2022 Early Festival,
especially on nights when Dave and Matt and or Kurt and Brian or you would be performing, that would often fall to me to be the only one up there. You know, if when we were doing it for like a week, you know, they might only be performing Friday night at 8 o'clock, say, or, you know, Thursday at 7:30, whatever it might be. So the rest of the night times there'd be two of us or even three of us up there, but sometimes it'd just be me, and I have no problem going up for 30 seconds and being like, all right, let's hear it for blank. And we really appreciate you guys. Let's keep it going for blank, you know? And I've been the God voice at Helium and Cobbs for forever, you know, and I got no problem talking into a mic when nobody can see me. So it's not like I'm completely shy about the whole thing. It's just, you know, just only goes so far.
Last two questions that I ask everybody on the podcast. And we kind of touched it on a bit, but like, you know, I think, you know, I phrased it to be a very specific piece of advice, but what's a general piece of advice that you would give to a new comic, whether it's a stand-up or a sketch comedian?
I think it's easier for this to be true for stand-ups, but it can definitely be true for sketch too. It's just sketch is much more collaborative, so sometimes it might be a little more difficult, but I think the funniest stuff always comes from being true to yourself and who you are. You know, the funniest stand-ups you'll see are it's funny because it always brings to mind one of my other loves, wrestling, but it's always like an amped up version of yourself.
Yeah.
You know, it's you turned up to 11 maybe, or turned down to 2 if your shtick is that you're a quiet deadpan person, you know. But like, I think always being true to yourself is the best way to find stuff that's purely funny and truly funny. So being who you are, even if it, you know, and like for sketch, it's going to be based in character most of the time, but finding who you are and writing to that is going to be your strength. whether you're a stand-up or a sketch comic, I think.
And then finally, you know, to be as deep as possible for a comedy podcast, right. You've spent basically your entire adult life working in comedy professionally as your, you know, 9-to-5, 40-hour a week job. And then you still play around with a festival that is not a paying job for you. Why comedy? Why has comedy been like such the driving force of your adult life?
I just feel like it's the best thing in the world because it can make the way that I've been able to be involved in it is a combination of kind of how I would like to live my life in general, I guess, because it brings me joy, but it also brings others joy at the same time. You know what I mean? Like it's not just something that makes me happy, but I can be happy and make other people happy at the same time, which is like the coolest, which is like the apex of it. You know, it's something that it's like how I imagine like a comic who has a joke that they've worked really hard on crafting when it hits and 275 people are laughing. It's like, oh, that makes me feel so happy because I wrote that, but it makes them feel so happy at the same time. That's great. Or like, you know, I don't know, Bryce Harper hits a grand slam and it makes him happy because he's just, you know, won the game for his team, but it also makes 42,000 people in the building happy. And like, that's got to be the best feeling to do both of those at the same time. So anywhere that I can do that, you know, and make myself and people that I care about or don't even know happy is a win. And comedy seems to be the best way to do that.
You're probably right. Is it
deep enough and makes sense?
Yeah, it does.
At the same time.
Thanks, Ben. All right, I talked way too much at the top of the show, so here's the abbreviated pitches. Philly Sketchfest returns May 31st through June 8th. Submissions for the live festival open Thursday, February 1st. Go to phillysketchfest.com. Cutthroat Sketch Heart at Salabona, February 1st, 7:30 p.m. Cutthroatsketch.com for tickets. Sketch Ball at Plays and Players Skinner Studio on February 28th at 7:30 p.m. Sketchballphilly.com. My First Sketch is a Philly Sketchfest production. You can find out more information at phillysketchfest.com. Follow Philly Sketchfest on Instagram at Philly Sketchfest. The music on this episode is by the band No No, which you can check out at nonoband.bandcamp.com. Like My First Sketch on Facebook. Rate, review, and subscribe wherever you get the podcast. This is Josh Hyam. Thanks for listening. Go see some comedy.